Happy Sabbath to everybody here. And John, it's good to see you. Good to see you here. Okay, the name of this particular message is called Pride versus Humility. And Gary Snyder gave a message on pride here back on the 13th, and this is a takeoff from that. Well, I wanted to find out exactly what pride meant. I didn't want to talk about something that wasn't about pride. And one of the things that pride talks about is a family of lions. So I realized that we have to go from a different spot. So it also said that we have an over-high opinion of ourselves. A little stronger message or a little stronger comment, an exaggerated opinion of ourselves, up to the point of arrogance. And occasionally you run into people like that. Another point it talks about is conceited, which means to delight in our achievements or our accomplishments. We do this, we do that, and we are lording it over other people. An example would be to say, where did you go to the feast? Well, I went local. Well, we went to Hawaii. We went a week ahead of time, and we stayed there a week after it, and we had a great time. We went fishing. We went surfing. We did all these things. That's what conceited is talking about. Well, in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, talks about pride and conceit, to be proud, and sets us up for Peter's warning here. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion. Well, the dictionary was right after all. Looking for someone to devour. Well, I also wanted to find out what the word humble actually meant. And it's talking about being modest, having or showing consciousness of one's own faults. Also means to be low in rank, low in position, or low in condition. Lonely, lowly, and unpretentious. Very interesting. 1 Peter 5 talks about humble and lowly in verse 6. Peter says, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may lift you up in due time. Cast all your worries on him because he cares for you. Verse 8, be self-controlled and alert. Verse 9, resist him, meaning resist Satan, standing firm in the faith because you know that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kind of suffering. The same kind of suffering. And verse 10 talks about God's grace. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong and firm and steadfast. From here, I'm going to go to Matthew 7, Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 7 and verse 1. Says here, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. And with what measure you use, it'll be measured back to you. Verse 3 speaks about the plank versus the speck of sawdust. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye? Why do you do that? And pay no attention to the plank that's in your own eye. How can you say to your brother, well, let's see, let me get the speck out of your own eye, or your eye, when all the time you have a plank in your own eye? We should be looking in the mirror. And what's the mirror? What's the mirror we should look into? It's this book we're holding, the Holy Bible, God's Holy Word. There's what we should look at. Well, from here, let's go to Cain and his brother Abel. This is in Genesis 4. Genesis 4 and verse 2. Well, here God must have given instructions, even though they're not recorded here. We don't know exactly what they were. But Abel brought fat portions, verse 4, from the firstborn of his flock. The Eternal looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Pride is taking over. You see, the Eternal, make a couple other comments here. Abel's offering was accepted, and we're not sure exactly what the reason was. Not because it was a lamb, and not because Abel was perfect. He wasn't any more perfect than Cain was. Nor because of his lamb was the very best. His lamb was the very best, but that wasn't the reason. I've often wondered if this had something to do with the very first Passover, because of the fact that Abel brought a lamb. Don't know that. But you see, Abel here was humble. He was humble and he obeyed God. And Cain did not. Pride was overrunning Cain, and humility was with Abel. Well, Cain became very angry. And in verse 6 and 7, God actually counsels Cain against his anger. Listen to this. Why are you angry, Cain? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? Of course he'll be accepted. But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. Verse 8. Cain could not or would not repent as he sinned. You see, Cain had too much pride. He couldn't admit an error. He couldn't admit that he was wrong. Now, Cain said to his brother in verse 8, "Let's go to the field." And while they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and murdered him. You see, Abel had a humble and lowly attitude about things. It was so hard for all of us as humans to admit when we're wrong. It's one of the hardest things there is to say that we do wrong. Today out at work, the phrase is, my bad, that's all there is to any wrong that's done. My bad. The youth bring that about. And that's what repentance was there for the people out at work. Well, from here, let's go to Genesis 37 and verse 2. We're going to take a look at Joseph. Joseph, this will be Jacob's young son. Genesis 32 and verse 2. We see here things start out bad for Joseph. Joseph, a young man of 17, was tending the flocks with his brothers. And he brought their father a bad report about them. So that didn't start off well at all. And things grow a little bit worse in verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than his other sons, because he had been born to him in his old age. And he made a richly ornamented robe for him. You see, troubles start in families when we pick a favorite child. And because we look at that child with more love, more concern, more laughter, more fun, more joking, and the other kids are left out, a wall of resentment begins to build up. It's not a good policy to do that at all. Try to treat everybody as fairly as we can. No one else had got a jacket or a coat like that. Well, in verse 5 to 7, Joseph's pride now begins to emerge. Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers, they hated him all the more. He said to them, "Listen to this dream I had. We were binding sheaves in the field, and out in the field, when suddenly my sheaf rose and stood upright, while your sheaves gathered around mine and bowed down to it." Verse 8, when we read it, we see his brothers hate him even more. His brothers said to him, "Do you indeed intend to reign over us? Will you actually rule us?" And they hated him all the more because of his dream and what he had said. Well, Joseph had a second dream, and he can't resist telling his brothers again. This is in verse 9. When he had the other dream, he told his brothers also. He said, "Listen, I had another dream, and this time the sun and moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." Not only that, he even goes and tells his father about the dream, and his father rebukes him. Listen to this. When he told his father as well as his brothers, his father rebuked him and said, "What is this dream you had? Will your mother and I and your brothers actually come and bow down to the ground before you?" Well, his brothers were jealous, but his father kept this matter in mind. His brothers had so much hate that they wanted to kill Joseph. And Judah comes up with an idea. He says, "Let's sell him to the slave traders." And the oldest brother, Reuben, also wanted to keep him alive, did not want to kill him. Well, Judah's plan to sell Joseph to the slave traders comes to pass in verse 28. So when the Midianites merchants came by, in verse 28, his brothers pulled Joseph out of the pit and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites. Humility begins to set into Joseph right now. What happens in verse 36? The Midianites sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. He moves from the top rung of the ladder down to become a slave. Huge change in his life. He's no longer proud. He's humble. In Proverbs 11 and verse 2, this is an interesting proverb, and it actually comes to pass here in a little bit. When pride comes, then comes disgrace. But when humility comes, then comes wisdom. When humility comes, then comes wisdom. Proverbs 11, 2. And we're going to see that happening in Joseph's life here. Genesis 39. Genesis 39, verse 2. The Eternal was with Joseph, and he prospered. And he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Eternal was with him and that the Eternal gave him success in every way, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted him to his care everything he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and of all that he owned, the Eternal blessed the household of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Eternal was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left in Joseph's care everything he had. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself about anything except the food he ate. Humility paid off in this case. And with humility came wisdom. And we see that because of all the blessings that God brought through Joseph because of his humility. He gave him wisdom and understanding. And Joseph took it to heart. Well, his master's wife makes a pass at Joseph and lands Joseph in jail. See, Joseph went to jail without a trial, without a hearing, without anything. This man grabbed him, took him down to the jail, and put him in. Put him in jail. However, verses 21 and 23, God was with Joseph in prison 100%. Joseph again climbs the tree to the ladder to the top rung. He's put in charge of everything in this jail. Everything. It's because of his humility, because of the wisdom that he gained from it. Just like Proverbs 11 and verse 2 talks about. Going on to chapter 40 and verse 13, Potiphar's cupbearer is put in prison with Joseph, and Joseph explains a dream. In 3 days, you will be back working for Pharaoh, your boss. Now in verse 14, Joseph says plainly, but when all goes well with you, everything's going well, and you get to Pharaoh, remember me, okay? Remember me. And show kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this prison. Get me out. I scratch your back, you scratch my back. Not too complicated. Is that what happened? Let's take a look at verse 23. The chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him. That happens so often. I know out at work, guys come and borrow tools and all kinds of things off my truck. Once they get their project done, there's times that I don't ever see those tools again. It's just the way human nature is. Human nature is that way. We get our thing out of the way, our worry, our problem, and then we forget about who helped us. It's just human nature. Okay, chapter 41 and verse 1. 2 years later, 2 years go by. Now Pharaoh has a dream, and none of his wise men are capable of interpreting this dream for him. And in verse 9, we now see the cupbearer apologizing for his faults. Or perhaps he wasn't apologizing, perhaps he was buttering his own bread, maybe to get advancement with Pharaoh. Verse 9, we read, the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, today I am reminded of my shortcomings. And then he goes on to explain what had happened to him in prison, and that there was a young Jewish lad, a Hebrew lad he calls him, who found out that what the dreams meant for these two men that were there. And he was returned back to his boss. So in verse 14, we see that after hearing this from the cupbearer, Pharaoh calls for Joseph. What happens? Pharaoh said to Joseph in verse 15, I had a dream and no one can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Now listen to Joseph's words. I cannot do it. I can't do it. I cannot interpret your dream. What an astounding amount of humility. But the eternal, you see, he's giving all the credit to Almighty God. The eternal will give Pharaoh the answer that he desires. So beautiful to read about humility. Just, it's fantastic. It's a great read. Well, let's go to Genesis 41 and verse 17. I'm not going to read it. Pharaoh explains his two dreams to Joseph. Verse 28, however, the Eternal has shown Pharaoh his plans, just like he had said earlier. Verse 28, it is just as I said to Pharaoh, this is Joseph speaking, God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. This is when the 7 years of plenty are coming. We talked about wisdom. The Eternal has shown Pharaoh his plans in verse 28. I've already read that. Well, Joseph gives his advice to Pharaoh, and it's very wise. It's just as Proverbs 11 and verse 2 says. He says, find the best, most humble, and capable of man, the wisest man, and put him in charge. Verse 33. I'm going to read that. Now let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Verse 34. Joseph's plan of action is as follows in verse 34. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. Now, one fifth of the abundance of the land didn't seem like it was near enough to me, but Joseph turned out he was right. Not only did a fifth of the produce keep Egypt sustained, it also sustained nations around him. It was a remarkable amount of grain. And I've always thought that was too little, but it's not the case at all. Verse 37. Pharaoh shows respect for Joseph. Now the plan seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, can we find anyone like this man? One in whom is the Spirit of God? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. Now suppose that you worked for Pharaoh for 25 years and a young man, some 30 years old, gets out of the slammer. And he's only been in Pharaoh's presence for 30 minutes. Let's double that and let's give him an hour. And Pharaoh overlooks you and all of the other wise men and puts this man second in command. Second in command. How would you feel if that was taking place? He overlooks you and puts this guy in charge. You can see here that in Proverbs 29 and verse 23, also it says, humble comes to a man and gains honor. Humility does that. Pharaoh is about to honor our friend Joseph. And Christ expects us to be humble just like Joseph was humble. Listen to the blessings that come his way. Chapter 41, verse 41. He's given total charge of a whole country. And Pharaoh only knew him for 30 minutes. But you can see the confidence that he put in him. He was humble, and God blessed him for it. Verse 41 says, I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt. What's the second blessing? Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's hand. What's a third blessing? He dressed him in robes of fine, fine linen. What's a fourth blessing? What's a fourth honor? He put a gold chain around his neck. And this isn't going to be one of those little chains that we see in the jewelry stores today. This thing probably weighed 2 to 3 pounds because some of the officials had large gold dressings. Not only that, sometimes we get a car to drive back and forth from work. Listen to this, the fifth blessing. Pharaoh had him ride in a chariot as second in command. What's the next blessing, the sixth one? Men shouted before him, make way, make way. Thus he put him in charge of the whole land of Egypt. Verse 44. Great authority has been given to him. Listen to this. I am Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all of Egypt. Now that's power. And that's after only knowing him for some 30 minutes or an hour. Well, Pharaoh gives him a new name, a name of honor. Not only that, he gives him a wife. This is the ninth thing that happens to him. And this can turn out to be a problem. He gives him Potiphar's daughter to marry. And Potiphar was the high priest of the sun god Re. And his daughter would be a sun worshiper. She'd been with her father all of her life. So Joseph has his hands full with the Sabbath and with other issues that could be a constant problem. But Joseph's humility would carry him through on these issues. I saw humility up close yesterday. There were eight of us, my wife and six others, that ate lunch yesterday over at the El Dorado golf course. And I was the last and final person to come, and there was no chair there. So I had to go to the people next to us to get a chair for to set at the table. And this lady makes a comment. She's in their older couple. There's two people sitting there, and there was an empty chair. So I ask if I could, yes, the guy says. And she says to me, well, there's only six allowed at a table. And if you take this chair, you'll be the eighth one. I said, yes. So I picked up the chair and moved it over there. And the waiters and everyone could have changed us and put two of us out and put us at another table. But they chose not to do that. They let us all eat there at the one table. We had a great time, by the way. Just great. Anyhow, after 45 minutes, this lady comes over and puts her hand on my shoulder. And I thought at first it was one of the waiters. But no, it was her. And she said, did my comments bother you in any way? I said, no, they didn't bother me at all. She said, I'm glad. She said, I'm glad of that. And she said, by the way, I loved your prayer. It was beautiful. I go home and I begin to think about this last episode of her humility. And I ask myself, would I have the humility to go over to her table with all of these people around and apologize like she did? And I thought about it for a while. And I said, I probably would not have been able to do that. And I come to the conclusion that not everyone is at the same level of hurt or pain or insult. This was enough to have insulted her if I spoke to her. But because I just blew it off as nothing, I probably would never have gone over there, because we all work at different levels of interest, all have different levels of things that we can take, of understandings and of insults and so on and so on. I just happen to have a little bit different tolerance for it. And I had moved on and never give it a second thought until I'd gotten home and saw what she actually had to go through to do that. I had to give her a lot of respect for that. And I couldn't do it in person. It was just that it took place, and I wanted to pass that along. So humility is still here with us today, although we don't see it a whole lot. But hopefully you're seeing some of it in this message. Okay, we're going to move on from here to a prophet named Jonah. prophet named Jonah. We know these things very well. And it's easier to see some of these things with the people we know than with the ones that we don't, at least from my point of view. Well, God instructs Jonah in Jonah 1:1 to preach against the city of Nineveh. However, Jonah runs off to Tarshish in a sailboat. God now sends a violent storm against this ship. And where is Jonah? Jonah's down below and he's sound asleep. This isn't bothering him one bit. Well, sailors decide that they want to cast lots to find out who was causing all these waves. And of course, the lot fell on Jonah. And in verse 9, we see Jonah explaining what's going on here. And that the crew, when they heard the word eternal, the God of creation, the crew was about, what have I got written here? Oh, when they heard the name eternal, that name terrified them. Let's read verse 9. And he answered, I'm a Hebrew, and I worship the eternal, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land. Verse 10, this terrified them when they asked, where are you from? What have you done? So this name bothered them a lot. Apparently they had heard it before, or they knew about David and Solomon and other leaders before them and how God had helped them so much. So in verse 12, Jonah comes up with a solution. He said, pick me up and throw me into the sea, and the sea will be calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you. What happens? The crew humbles themselves in verse 13. And they cried out to the Eternal, O Eternal, please do not die. Please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. For you, O Eternal, have done as you pleased. What happens? Then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. Verse 16, humility grows and grows among the crew. And here's what happens now. At this, the men greatly feared the Eternal and offered a sacrifice to the Eternal and made vows to him. But the Eternal provided a great fish, verse 17, to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and three nights. This is where Christ talks about him being in the grave 3 days and three nights, the same as Jonah was in the giant fish. That's in Matthew 12, verse 40. Well, the fish vomits Jonah up on the land, and God talks to him a second time. Well, wait a minute. I'm going to read some of Jonah's prayer because this is interesting. You see humility in this. So Jonah loses his pride now because he's in the belly of this fish and he cannot get out. He needs help. Verse 2, Jonah begins to talk to God and he says, in my distress, I called on the Eternal and he answered me. From the depths of the grave, I called for help. And you listen to my cry, verse 4. And I said, I have been banished from your sight. Yes, he was. Yet I will look again toward your holy temple. And he does. In verse 6, he says, to the roots of the mountains I've sank. The earth beneath barred me in forever. But you brought my life up from the pit. Oh, eternal my God, Jonah knows his life hangs in the balance in verse 7. When my life was ebbing away, I remembered you, O eternal, and my prayer rose to you, to your holy temple. Verse 8, he's talking about people that cling to worthless idols, and that's going on even to this day. Those who cling to worthless idols forfeit the grace that God would give to them. You see, a piece of silver or a piece of gold fashioned into an idol can't save Jonah. A piece of wood all carved up in an idol can't save him either. A stone that they chip away at, it's not going to save them. These things are all dead. And we have seen a change and a humility of Jonah's heart in verse 9. But I, with a song of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you. What I have vowed, I will make good. Salvation comes from the eternal. Okay, now God talks to Jonah a second time. Chapter 3, verse 1. The word of the eternal came to Jonah a second time. Go to that great city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I give you. Two words are all it takes to understand Jonah. Jonah obeyed. That was his response, was humility. What does Jonah do on the day one, verse 4? On the first day, Jonah started into the city. He proclaimed 40 more days and Nineveh will be overturned. 40 days, that's all you've got is 40 days. Now in verse 5, the worst thing happens to Jonah. And his pride is hurt. And it's hurt badly. What happens? The Ninevites, verse 5, believed God. They declared a fast, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. That's the last thing Jonah wanted to have happen. He wanted to see fire and destruction come because that's what he was preaching. It didn't come at all. These people actually repented. They got rid of their pride and humbled themselves. When the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. Verse 7, he makes this proclamation. Do not let any man or beast, herd or flock, taste anything. These animals can't possibly sin. But anyway, he said, don't let them eat or drink. But let man and beast be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent and with compassion turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. He sounds like a prophet himself because this is what the prophets talk about doing. Give up your violence. Give up all the evil ways that you're doing. And that's just what happened. Well, this thing bothers him to no end. In chapter 4 and verse 1, what's happening here? Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. He became angry over this. Here these people are repenting, which is what God wanted them to do, and Jonah's mad about it. He prayed to the Eternal, verse 2. O Eternal, is this not what I said when I was still at home? That's why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you were a gracious God, that you were a compassionate God, that you're slow to anger, that you're abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, O Eternal, take away my life, for it's better for me to die than to live. But God replied, have you any right to be angry, Jonah? So from there, Jonah goes out and sets down under a cave of some kind, and God provided a large vine to grow up and permitted Jonah to sit under the shade. Well, the next day, God allows the vine to be, or the plant to be, destroyed. Now, in verse 8, Jonah is angry again and wants to die. Let's read verse 8. When the sun rose, God provided a scorching east wind, and the sun blazed on Jonah's head, so he grew faint, and he wanted to die. It would be better for me to die than to live. But God said to Jonah, do you have any right to be angry about this fine? I do. I've got a lot of right to be angry. I'm angry enough to die. That's what. But the Eternal said to him, you see, his pride has come back. His pride is back. We thought it was gone forever. Not gone forever, it's come back. And the Eternal said, you have been concerned about this vine. Though you didn't tend it or make it grow. You see, what Jonah is looking at would be similar to this microphone right here. But not concerned about the whole room of people we have here today. Jonah still didn't understand. He still didn't get it properly. He wasn't humble yet. Wasn't humble the way that he should be. He just didn't understand humility. He understood pride, but he didn't understand humility. He couldn't admit that he was wrong. Well, our own human nature makes it very difficult to admit that we're wrong. And we can see that in these examples here. We can probably see it in our own life. It's very difficult to admit that we're wrong on anything. But that is where we have to start to change. Before we can change, we have to admit first that we're wrong about things. And when we admit that we're wrong, then things begin to change. That's when repentance takes place. That's when things really start to work out for good, when humility takes over. Brethren, have a great Sabbath.